Sorry for the slight delay, but we had some other problems in the Medientheater. This is the beginning of a two-hour session by Jörn Ettingsmeier and Steve Harris about audio engineering in a nutshell. We will do now the first part, followed by roughly 1 hour lunch break, and then continue afterwards. It's going to be a lot of material that they have. I hope they are able to rush through the slides. But anyway, whoever wants to start, go ahead.
Yes, thanks, Frank. Well, basically, we have quite a tight schedule, as you might be able to deduce from the structure we've shown there. What we try to do in this talk is to sort of cover everything that you might need. And our the target audience we had in mind is people who probably have some experience with working with computers, doing sound with computers, without ever really digging into why it works or how it works. And you might have run into some problems that you couldn't really make sense of or understand, or how, and not find out how to work around them. And this is just to sort of get through all the basic things that you might have to do and want to do with digital audio, and learn some basics that you might overlook when just using the stuff. And to do that, we also go into the analog domain, because that's where it all comes from, and this is very interesting to look at, to understand how it works. And then you can, from there on, you can move on and see how it's done in the digital domain. Okay, first of all, some very low-down basics, and we're going to just rush through that. We do something about sound and hearing, analog signals and digital signals. This might actually, the digital signals might actually cover most of the first half. Then we go on to basic digital operations, which we need later on when we go into the actual application of that technique. Then we're going to talk about controlling timing with delays, controlling spectrum by equalization, controlling dynamics with compressors and expanders, and if we have the time, just some brief ideas and concepts about space and spatialization. And we see this is totally packed, and we're going to rush through it for 2 hours straight, except you have the lunch break to recover. And there's even going to be some math, because we couldn't do without. What we do is we start at the very beginning. You'll be able to ask questions after each section, briefly. And we'll explain everything twice. That is, me is doing the stuff from the analog point of view, and then Steve is going to talk about how it's done in the digital domain. And at the very end, we have another Q&A session for questions that might not relate directly to one of those topics, but you still might want to ask. So let's start with the nature of sound and its representation, sound and hearing. Now, sound is pressure waves basically traveling through a medium. And those sound waves consist of alternating high and low pressure zones, which oscillate in the direction of travel, as opposed to the usual depiction of sine waves, which are transversal. Sound waves are longitudinal waves. They travel through the air at approximately 340 meters per second. I just depicted that V0. This is our sound speed. We're going to use that later. And the oscillating speed of sound of the air particles is called the frequency F, which is measured in cycles per second, or hertz. From that, we can compute the wavelength, which is exactly the distance of one high and one low pressure zone. And it obeys the law of lambda, which is the wavelength equals sound, speed of sound divided by frequency. Now, we detect the sound with our eardrums. Trivial, everybody of you will know that. So it works like a microphone diaphragm. It moves along with the pressure waves. Now, the remarkable thing is the softest sound humans can hear is an air pressure change of only 0.00002 Pascal, which compared to the normal standard pressure of 1,023 hectopascal is quite remarkable. The loudest sound, on the other hand, we can endure, has a local pressure change of 200 Pascal, which is 10 orders of magnitude of intensity. In the frequency domain, our ability to detect sounds reaches from 20 hertz to 20 kilohertz, where the upper band, of course, as you may know, moves down, deteriorates with age. The interesting thing to note here is that we perceive frequency as pitch in a logarithmic fashion, meaning pitch intervals are ratios of frequencies, not differences. Like the sound difference between a sine of 100 hertz and a sine of 200 hertz sounds very different from one of 1,000 hertz and 1,100 hertz. So So this is something we have to keep in mind when doing computations later on. And the range from a given frequency to twice that frequency is called an octave, a musical octave. We will need that later on too. So to deal with signal levels, we need the dreaded decibel, which is the only way to handle these 10 orders of magnitude. To compute a sound pressure level, we first measure the actual sound pressure, and then we normalize it to our hearing threshold. Basically, we do that by dividing the pressure P by our threshold P0. And then we apply the logarithm function just to compress this huge range of 10 orders of magnitude into manageable numbers. So the unit of musical loudness is dB sound pressure level, which is 20 logarithm P divided by P0. And this refers to loudness measurements in air. For signals, we use the same technique, but we talking about voltage in signals, and we use reference voltage. Unfortunately, there are two standards, either 1 volt or 0.775 volts, and those are called dBV, capital V, or dBU. Now, it's important to keep in mind that, that the decibel is not an absolute measure. It's absolutely meaningless without stating the reference, which is either a pressure reference or a voltage reference. Now, on to analog signals. Now we're going to really start. It's trivial. A microphone transfers a sound wave into a signal, and it happens via magnetic induction. And the microphone diaphragm moves.
Bit so you can't perceive the error, isn't it? Here's the same signal quantized to 4 bits. Right, and you can hear it sounds, there's a lot of noise on it. And here's just the noise in isolation. So that's this bottom waveform here. So it sounds noisy, but also you can hear there's a part of the original sine wave is in the quantization noise. It's been parts of it are sort of leaked through, so it's not even pure white noise. It's actually quite complex distortion, and I'll come to why and what you do about that in a minute. So, back to the ideal low-pass filter. There is actually an ideal low-pass filter, and it's this sinc function, which is sine of pi x over pi x. I don't actually know why it's that or how you get to that, but it is. The only problem with this is it's non-terminating. It has non-zero values for minus infinity, well, up to minus infinity and plus infinity. So the function you have to evaluate is infinitely wide, so you can't ever calculate it correctly. All you can do is approximate it. And what you do to turn a discrete signal back into a continuous signal on a theoretical level is you replace every impulse in the PCM signal with this sinc waveform. In practice, you window it, which means slice it, just slice off the end. So you just cut, let it decay down to a reasonable value and then cut it. So here, and in all the examples I've used in this slide, I've used minus 50 to plus 50, but there's just a trade-off between how much error you get. So, and this is the ideal brick wall low-pass filter. So here's... why you have to do this this sinc interpolation. You've got this signal here, which is actually a sine wave very close to the Nyquist frequency. And the impulse rendering of it just looks like a complete mess. And if you do something stupid like linear interpolate it, you can see it's rubbish. There's no signal there at all. But when you use sinc interpolation, it actually recovers the sine wave perfectly. There's no loss, because this is a completely accurate representation of that high-frequency sine wave. And now we have showing the example of convolution, which is the process of adding these sinc waveforms to the to replace the impulses. So here we've just done one in the middle, and the next one, you can see they've added together to form this smoother wave shape. And it progressively goes more and more. I could have carried on forever, and it just reconstruct that sine wave. Yeah, as I said, this is a process called convolution. So, back to the problem of the quantization noise containing some of the source signal. Here we have this wave. This is a sine wave which has been sampled at 4-bit. And you can see that there are repeated... I've cheated here slightly, and I've made the sine wave a direct... Or sorry, the sampling rate is a direct multiple of the frequency of the sine wave, but it works for all frequencies, and this just makes it easier to see what's happening. You can see that there's regular features caused by the interrelations between the sample rate and the sine wave itself. And you can see, even on the reconstructed continuous signal, there's a sort of bulge here, and there's a ripple at the top, which are... And because they're regularly repeated components in the signal, they're perceived as tones because they are, well, because they're repeating signals. And here you can see this is the quantization error from converting this PCM signal back into a continuous signal and comparing it with the source signal. And you can see quite clearly here that there are repeating patterns in the thing which are perceived as tones. So, in order to combat this, what you actually do, slightly oddly, is add noise to the signal before you do the conversion to PCM. So here you can see that the same bulge is now moving up and down randomly on the side of the sine wave, and the peaks at the top are all different. So, but you can see that this signal is now much less pure sine wave than it was previously, but the repeating patterns have gone. So this is trading off encoding accuracy for signal-to-noise ratio. And here you can see the frequency graph of the equivalent signal. So this was the signal which had no dither applied. It had the regular repeating patterns, and they show up as harmonics of the sine wave. And if I play the sine wave, you should be able to hear them. This is a, I think it's an 8-bit sine wave, about minus 30 dB, something like that. But you can hear it sounds quite harsh. There's a lot of harmonics. It sounds almost like a square wave. And that's just caused by the intermodulation distortion. And here's the equivalent where we've applied dither. So we've got white noise, which just blankets off at minus 70 decibels. So you don't get this these troughs of signal-to-noise ratio. But all the harmonics have gone. So it sounds like a pure sine wave superimposed on top of white noise. So if I play it back. So again, that demonstrates the trade-off between the between accurate reconstruction, but you get some noise and harmonic distortion caused by intermodulation. In general, you have to perform, theoretically, you have to perform this step every time you reduce the bit depth, because whenever you truncate a signal, either from a continuous signal which has to be reduced to PCM, or from a high bit width PCM to the narrow bit width PCM, you ideally should do this process to prevent this harmonic distortion building up. Right. Brief aside. In addition to the octave thing that Jörn described earlier, there's also humans don't perceive all frequencies with equal with equal loudness. So you can see here that this a signal at 1 kilohertz is perceived to be something like 60 dBs louder than one at 30 or so. And you can exploit this when it comes to dithering. If you, instead of using white noise, if you use a signal which has most of its energy in the high frequencies where human hearing is not very sensitive and has much lower energy in the, around the sort of 1 to 4 kilohertz region where we're most sensitive, then and still have the same amount of energy, so it's got enough, there's enough signal in there to prevent intermodulation distortion occurring, but the energy's moved to places where it's not quite so audible. So if we compare, this is the original rectangular dithered, it's called triangular dithering because it's got this slope on it, and there are various kinds of dithering with different slope names. This is the rectangular, just using white noise, is the easiest one to implement. This is the second easiest. It's not really any harder. But it gives a quite noticeably different effect. So this is the rectangular dithered sine wave. And here we have the triangular one with most of the energy in the high frequencies. And you should be able to hear that the the perceived signal-to-noise ratio is much higher in the triangular dithered sine wave. This is a psychoacoustic trick because it's playing on the insensitivities of the human ear. So it only works in audio, and it only works if you're not going to do anything with the frequency spectrum. If you're the next thing you're going to do is shift these frequencies around using something like Freak Tweak or whatever, then it makes things much worse because suddenly you have this lot of high-frequency noise energies moved down into audible spectra. And there are various other tricks for packing more energy into dither, making it less audible. It's possible to use extremely high-amplitude noise right up against the Nyquist frequency, which is... humans can barely hear it, and it tends to be killed by analog circuitry anyway. So that's an extremely good perceived signal-to-noise ratio, but it's also incredibly hard to implement. Okay, questions about the digital portion?
Any questions? Julian?
To improve these aliasing problems, couldn't you just take something like Frag Tweak and work in the FFT with the FFTs and just really cut out all the frequencies above your Nyquist frequency?
Well, in order to do that, you have to somehow capture the signal into a PCM system so that something like Freak Tweak can work on it. And you can't convert it into PCM until you've done the anti-aliasing. Once you've reduced the sample rate of a signal and introduced aliasing, you can no longer remove it because you can't distinguish the alias components from the original ones. In the diagrams I drew, you could kind of see that they were different, but in real life, they're just scattered randomly, and there's no way of extracting them from the ones you want.
Yeah, but if you're downsampling, you can do it.
Yeah, well, that's what you're doing. In practice, you use like the sync waveform I showed to downsample to low-pass filter the signal before you resample it into the lower sample rate. That's exactly what you do. Yeah, you use a low-pass filter.
Okay.
Anyone else? Okay, then just a short message in between. Apologies to those outside listening to the audio streams. We had some small crash on the routing machine, and so the streams were reconnected but crossed. So if you want to listen to the lecture hall stream, go to the media theater. If you go to the media theater, you know the drill. We'll be fixed in about 10 minutes. And now it's back to Jon.
Maybe it should be noticed that the crash on that routing machine, it's a Windows NT. And it's not our streaming server, which has been running for 2 weeks without problems. Thank you very much. Any time left?
Yeah, we've got 10 minutes.
We're going to use them. How sorry, it's not. We've got 10 minutes. We don't have to tear down any stuff later. Okay, it's yours. I think it's your part next.
Yep. So. Okay, I'm just going to whip through this quickly because it's really obvious, but it just needs to be said to make sense of the next part. So, mixing signals in the PCM domain is exactly the same as it is in the continuous domain. You add them together using plus in C or the sum operation in maths or any other kind of adding type thing. Gain is multiplication. So if you want to do minus 20 dB attenuation, which is a factor of 0.1, exactly, many people think that minus 6 dBs is 0.5, but that's not true. It's not quite. The only one that's perfect are the multiples of 20, which are the decimal orders of magnitude of gain. So that's a minus 20 dB gain. If you want to do generic gain in decibels, you can use this power function in C to turn the gain in decibels into a linear coefficient you can just multiply. That's pretty trivial. Panning, that's slightly more complicated. It's a gain operation. Imagine you've got a single mono signal that you want to pan between two stereo sources. The obvious thing to do is a linear crossfade so that when the pan's at the far left, the right channel has zero amplitude, and the left channel has full amplitude, and the opposite in the other direction, which is straight lines. However, if you do this, because of the way humans perceive relative volume, it sounds like there's a dead spot in the middle. Hopefully, there's enough stereo separation to hear it. Did you hear it? It sounded like it was getting quieter in the middle and louder again, even though the amplitude of the waveform is constant, because it was just a single sine wave panned between the two channels. You don't perceive it that way. So what you want to do is a constant power pan. This isn't constant power is usually defined as being, or the power of a signal is a stereo signal. It's generally the left signal squared, or the amplitude of the left signal squared, plus the amplitude of the right signal squared. And so this is just the obvious transformation back from that. So we maintain so that this red signal, this red amplitude squared plus this green amplitude squared is 1, and it comes out to be the square root of 1 minus the pan value squared. And this is much. This is gives a constant power, so you don't really perceive any drop in volume as you pan across. But it has another side effect, or it has a side effect, that because of the shape of this curve, it doesn't appear to pan across the spectra, across the stereo field linearly. It kind of sticks near one channel and then flies across the middle and then sticks near the other at the other end as you pan across. And there are lots of these constant power curves that have different trade-offs of linearity as you pan across and not quite constant power. Another fundamental operation on digital systems is delay. Here we've got a simple 11-sample delay line. Put a sample in here. Every time the sample clock ticks, it rolls one down, and you pull them out the other end. That's pretty simple. It's just memory. Memory and delay are the same thing. It's a case of having something now, putting it somewhere, getting it back sometime later. There's not really much said that. It gets complicated if you want to have varying delay, but for constant delay, it's just trivial. Didn't I move that?
I don't think so.
Okay. Right. Filtering operations are... All basic filtering operations are constructed from combinations of mixing, gain, and delay. So this is the simplest first-order low-pass rectangular filter, I think that's what it's called, which has the output is the input plus the input from the last sample divided by 2. So here's the block diagram of it. You've got the input. There's a single sample delay which just holds the value and then regurgitates it next clock, added together, and then gained. You can see from this that the output signal here is composed of the current input signal and the previous input signal. And this causes a phase shift, which is varies with frequency. But depending on the frequency, the output signal is related to the input signal by varying time. It's kind of hard to explain.
Maybe we can just come back to that when we talk about...
Yeah, we come back to the phase later. But you can see from this that the output signal is not just composed of the current signal. It's also got some historical values in it. I think that's probably a good place to stop.
I think that's it, yeah, right. And we get to the practical applications in the next session. Right, okay. Enjoy your break.
Okay, then, so we'll be having the lunch break now and continue with the second part at 2 p.m.